The 58th Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which begins on August the 8th, sees the world's biggest arts festival swelling to an even more gargantuan size than ever. For the record, this year there will be some 25,326 performances of 1,695 shows by 735 companies in 236 venues. That means that more than 15,500 performers will be treading the city's myriad improvised boards. Apparently, it would take 5 years and 53 days to see every performance back to back, and it would certainly take far longer than this afternoon's session to outline the theatrical fare on offer this year. Thumb through the pages of the 2004 programme, and you're going to be bamboozled by the variety of shows on offer. They're performed in spaces ranging from the well-heeled Traverse Theatre to a replica lift in the Pleasance Courtyard and an Indian takeaway in Leith. There's heaps of Shakespeare, bags of Sarah Kane, mountains of Harold Pinter, all jostling for attention aside a plethora of new works. Standing out from the crowd immediately are the celebrity-tinted affairs such as Killing Paul McCartney, Finding Mick Jagger, and Hunting Diana. Jeffrey Archer, Judy Burchill, Lucian Freud, Myra Hindley, and Orson Welles all have shows dedicated to them too. Hitler Sells Tickets runs the cynical title of a new play by the comic Boothby Grafo, and he's probably right. Selling tickets is something the Fringe has become rather good at. Last year, more tickets were sold than ever before, breaking the million ticket barrier for the first time. It might seem a little curmudgeonly to ask, what's the point of it all? But such financial success raises a number of important questions. Is the Fringe becoming more and more a money-making venture? And if so, who's making the money? With the cost of taking a show to the Fringe going ever upwards, what price do performers who are just starting out have to pay to get attention? And is the final cost a downward pressure on experimentation and risk? With me to ponder the state of the Edinburgh Fringe today are Christopher Richardson, director of the Pleasance Theatre, Sheridan Humphreys, who's head of press and marketing at C Venues, and the critics Dominic Maxwell, who has just hot-footed it from Time Out down here, and Ian Shuttleworth, who is a reviewer for the Financial Times and editor of Theatre Record magazine. Both of them have seen what life is like on the Fringe as a performer. So I think, starting off really, we'll talk to the people who actually make the Fringe happen, Christopher Richardson and Sheridan Humphreys. Before we get down to the practicalities of how you actually take a show to the festival, I just wondered, Christopher, you started the Pleasance, I think, 21 years ago?
20 years ago.
20 years ago.
19, it's our 20th season.
20 season, I'm terrible at maths. Mm. But clearly it must have changed, the Fringe itself must have changed a huge amount since you started out. I mean, do you recognise the description that's constantly thrust its direction now, that it's a rather sort of bloated, money-making enterprise that's kind of lost its kind of spirit a little bit? Does that strike
you? It's always been accused of being that, ever since I can remember it. When I first went out there, which is some 5 or 6 years before I started the Pleasance, it was always like that. It was the Oxbridge Mafia, then there was Circuit, which was considered death to art, and it didn't last for all that long. Then we had William opening Assembly, and he managed to get it a bit right. He's the only one who's lasted. I mean, he started all those sort of so-called major venues. But it's always been under attack for something. We are now seen as, well, we were seen as mega venues. Now there are other people coming along who are going to be seen like that too. I should have did and gone when that's happened.
Well, one of them is C Venues, I think. So they've been rising through the ranks very rapidly. I lose track of the number of actual venues that are attached to the C brand at the moment. There seem to be at least, nearly 10, I think.
Well, there's right? 10 theatres, but 5 locations.
What do you make of that claim that some of these mega venues are now in effect have created a two-tier festival and that in a sense most people.
Well, firstly, when you talk about all this money going into it, who's making the money? I'd like to know, because running one of the biggest venues, what goes in certainly goes out. But I mean, there's always going to be some level of two-tier, isn't there, in theatre? It's the same as the West End and the Fringe. It's not what I plan to say, come down here and say. But I still think that the Fringe remains the best showcase for new work, and whether or not that's through a two-tier system, that's the jobs of the critics to find out where the best shows are, and not necessarily just follow the the biggest sponsor banners or the biggest signs or that still come to my thing.
is it the case that you say, oh, who makes the money? So there is a slight assumption that Pleasance and Assembly Rooms and now I guess Sea Venues, Gilderballoon, the bigger names, that they do have very high turnovers, that they are the sort of
can
part
I, can
of
I stop
it.
You just there? Yes, make is different from turnover. Mm. And the fact is that, we have 200,000 visitors to our spaces, and we take something like £1.5 million on the box office. But we hang on to 40% of that, which has to pay ever-increasing rents, ever-increasing costs of things. I mean, people say it's all so much more expensive, but a loaf of bread is more expensive than it was 20 years ago, and everything always goes on going up. The people who make the money are the people of Edinburgh, and it's a very, very simple fact. We may have 200,000 people come through. They are probably going to two shows each, so that's 100,000, because these figures that go flashing around can be thirded at least, because, of course, they are the same people going around the same bit. And the larger it gets, the more people come up to perform and then go and see things. So it is a sort of self-feeding exercise. But somebody reckoned it was 200 million that is made in local spend by all the festivals. Some people think it's much, much more than that, which means that our little courtyard actually brings with it something like 10 or 11 million pounds in local spend. And you only have to divide 200 or even 100,000 into that to see roughly what everybody has to spend up there. Those are the people. It costs much, much more to stay in a flat. It costs much, much more to have a cup of coffee in Edinburgh during August than it does at any other time. And all those things are making money for lots of people, not the poor, wretched companies who come up. Of course, if you are Dara O'Brien, you take more on the box office than anybody else, but relative to what you could do for half an hour on telly, it is very small beer. Of course, the good companies and the good, the well-known people take more money, but they're not actually earning vast sums.
It's also much, much more complex than some of the remarks here have suggested. We're discussing the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. That's not by any means the only thing that's going on in Edinburgh in August. What's usually referred to as the Edinburgh Festival consists of the Fringe, the International Festival, the Jazz Festival, the Book Festival, the Film Festival, the TV Festival, the Tattoo, have I missed any? Bound to be at least one or two other.
There are a few other things as well.
The People's Festival.
Yes, and likewise talking
it's
about
a craft festival. I think goes on
there
somewhere.
There's a burlesque festival.
Yeah,
as the craft fair on the Mound, and likewise talking about a two-tier venue system. That's also, I think, really rather geared towards generating a headline issue than actually conveying a sense of the reality. Yes, there are the large venues. There's Assembly. I'd still say that Assembly, Pleasance, to an extent, Gilderballoon, are on a level of their own. Sea coming up very close behind, also the Underbelly in recent years. These many, many tiers, there's the Travers Theatre, which straddles the Fringe and the International Festival. All kinds of systems of organisation and definition. You can slice according to taste, so trying to create topics is...
Yeah, but I'll quote in that case immediately from Theatre Record last year, because Ian Herbert,
before my time,
your former editor, said, he admitted that he looked at this in that sort of tranche-like way. He said, already the major British touring companies have found it no longer worth the cost as a showcase. Major overseas companies are no longer much in evidence, and those who do arrive to find empty houses are unlikely to return. This situation is likely to get worse when fringe companies realise that their already slim chance of being spotted by a national reviewer is steadily disappearing altogether. The London reviewers seldom venture beyond the staple Travers, Assembly, Pleasance, as it is. If they resort to day trips, they're even less likely to wander into a small venue. I mean, it's not just I'm inventing this kind of tier. There is a kind of given, isn't there, that a lot of the, and this is because some of these venues have been around for a long time, that there's a concentration of activity in some of these venues, which means that effectively there are own little bubbles in a way. You can create a huge amount of attention within those spheres, and you don't have to go very far out to find anything else. I mean, Dominic, just before we go around again, what do you make of the
Well, yeah, undeniably, with so much to choose from, the fact that there are these three major fringe venues, you do tend to gravitate towards them, whether you're reviewing or whether you're buying your own tickets. There's so much to choose from, and even within those, there's a hell of a lot to choose from. But yes, absolutely, there is some sort of recommendation by virtue of the fact they're on at one of those three venues. Now, of course, you can still see something that's terrible there, but you just know your chances are a lot better. And also, there's also practical things, such as if you go and see something and you can't get in, which often happens with some of the hotter tickets. If you go to the Pleasance Courtyard, say, you know you've got a very good chance of seeing something within the next 20, 30 minutes that you probably would want to see.
I mean, there is, I suppose, I mean, we don't want to be banging on a sort of tired drum about, I suppose, the potentially debilitating effect of a large venue. I think that's very much open to a longer debate, which will probably go around in circles. But do you think, I mean, the Pleasance has expanded in recent years. C Venues is clearly expanding at the moment. Is that expansion because you really, in order to carry on functioning in some ways, it sort of has to create this expansive role?
It's a bit of that. We did have a thing called Over the Road, which was two, three venues, which we set up because we had problems. We had problems simply of finding spaces. Then we didn't have that because the university sold it, and we had to take another space called the Dome, which is in Potter Row, in order, particularly, because, to cater for people late night, because our neighbours were getting increasingly upset because we seemed to be successful and there were so many people coming. So we needed somewhere people could go after midnight, because we're not allowed to be open much after midnight. And so we got another space. And then we were told this year we couldn't have some of the bits in the Dome, but we were allowed to find some other bits where we were. So we've expanded in that sense. Mm. I'd much rather contract onto our courtyard and stay there. But the fact is that, you know, you need, A, that a lot of people want to come, and B, we've got to go on having the little companies as well. That's what we started as and what we want to do. But you need some of the big companies in order to pay enough to have the little companies.
Mm. Why do you think it is that, I mean, this is just a general question about London versus Edinburgh. London, you know, there may be 10 to 15 fringe openings a week. I think it doesn't really modulate much beyond that. In Edinburgh, you're going to face competition of up to sort of, I don't know, 300 openings in 1 week. Why did fringe companies put themselves into those odds? Do you have a reason for that?
I've got one, but somebody else might have a more intelligent one, yes.
I've got one. I think because you get so many more people coming to your show at Edinburgh. You've got so much more chance of getting the critic in to review your show in Edinburgh. I mean, Time Out can't possibly review every fringe show. I mean, they review most of them, but, you know, every fringe show opening in London. You're very likely to be picked up and join a touring circuit if your show's good enough. And, you know, and also going to Edinburgh is a really good way of finding out if you are good enough.
I think there's a really good sense of being in the game when you're at Edinburgh.
Yeah.
I mean, you can open at the Latchmere or whatever, and it might do well. Nothing might happen. But even if you're doing quite badly at the fringe, you're near people who are doing well, and it's such a long time. You've got 3.5 weeks, and you are to some extent motored by the thought that magic could happen, that someone could come along, whether it be a reviewer, whether it be a producer, and somehow by sheer commitment, you'll hang on in there. I was, when I did a couple of shows at the Pleasance in the mid-90s, we had to keep starting late because there was a sketch act called The League of Gentlemen who were just on before us. And, of course, since they got so much applause and so much laughter, they kept overrunning. Now, it didn't actually bring a trickle down to our show. You know, we went home pretty much unchanged. But there was part of the addictive element of it, I think, is the sense that that could rub off on you. And the sense that when you come out into the Pleasance Courtyard, say, or one of the sort of the bars in the other areas, you're all on the same turf.
Yes, there's a great intensity there, as you say, and the potential for takeoff is greater. But also, it still tends to that imaginative element of what might happen tends to distort the reality of what does. I was interested to see. Sheridan started off by saying, well, so many more people are going to come, and then she immediately switched from people to critics as if they were the people that mattered. The last figures I have are a few years out of date. I think they're from 2001 or so. But the average audience per Edinburgh Fringe performance was 11. I was surprised that it was that high.
That's an enormous jump. It used to be seven.
Mm, yes.
And that's not per show. That's per run.
It's per. Yeah, it's per performance. I mean, yes.
Yeah.
And certainly when I was. When I was also performing at the Pleasance in the mid to late 90s, that's, I think, yeah, that was about the size of audience we averaged, and we had to compete with Lee and Herring going up at the same time in a neighbouring space who were, as a novelty act, buying our punters' tickets back from them and offering them free admission into their place. So a lot of underhand and imaginative creative marketing tactics go on, even in the queues.
No, I should say, one thing we all have in common is we've all done a show at Pleasance, although I wasn't in it, but what Dominic was saying, that when the show that was on before us started selling out and got a 5-star review, we started to get excited about that. And then a few days later, we got a 5-star review as well. So there is that thing that could happen. And it does, I noticed that when shows in our venue get 5-star reviews, it does inspire everyone else. It's like, oh, maybe it'll be us next.
Yeah, well, I think there's another thing. If you are, with respect to Biggleswade, if you are the Biggleswade Terpsichorean dancers and you want a good time, you come to Edinburgh in August and you take a space which is probably somewhere out in Leith. And one of the main reasons you've come is because you want to be amongst like-minded people and you want to go and see lots of things. And the cheapest way to go and do it is come and bring your own show, and you're there all the time and you do it. And that's what I said at the beginning, is that it is this self-generating exercise. And there is no, for me, there's no better place to be in the world than August in Edinburgh. And it is, people just come for that purpose. It's not actually to make the money. And they are the people who supply the audiences. And they may go away having only had 7 people a day in their thing, but they have got a great deal out of it. For technicians who go and work there, but young people who come straight from college or still at college who come and work there in August, I have known nobody who really wanted a job in theatre who didn't get one if they had been to the festival. There are a lot of people who don't. That's not what they're there for. And there are a lot of people who come up. I mean, one little example, there was a young man on the telephone from Australia, and it was long after we'd put the programme to bed. And I said, well, it is far too late, but what do you do? And he said, well, we go on stage and people seem to think we're funny. And so I said, well, you'd better come and let's try and find somewhere where you can do something. And they were the Doug Anthony All-Stars. And the following year, there was a nice voice from Belfast on the telephone, and the young man said, you know, what do we do to get there? And I said, well, you have to be nice to me and call me sir and laugh at my jokes. So he proceeded to do that. And I said, what do you do? He said, we go on stage and people seem to think they're funny. And they were awful. And I said, it was the worst comedy group I'd ever seen. And I don't remember what the names are, but one of them came out to me some years later and said, you do mean that? And I said, yes, I did mean that. And he, of course, is now a highly successful governor of Australia or something.
It's always the Australians, isn't it?
Yeah, well, no. They're lovely, but we send some back. Yeah.
Well, I imagine that the funnier you are, the better you fare in Edinburgh. I mean, I do want to perhaps make a distinction at this point between the genres in the programme, which are comedy and theatre. And, you know, while there are a few figures knocking around, the Fringe office did establish about 2 years ago that the average cost of venue hire was £110 per 100 seats per night in Edinburgh, which seemed to me to mean that you were going to have a really steep bill at the end of 3 weeks if you took on an average-sized space or a moderately good space. Theatre practitioners clearly have a slightly tougher time getting the money together to come up to the festival if they're doing something more than a one-man or one-woman show. I mean, you, Dominic, in your case, you took a comedy show, series of comedy shows to the festival.
Yeah.
Is that right? I mean, did you feel that you couldn't take a theatre show? Did you feel that that was a different league altogether?
Well, they were sort of comedy slash theatre, which a lot of things are, and actually that's one of the things about Edinburgh, partly because, well, for all sorts of reasons, is that the dividing line between comedy and theatre is often quite small. And in one sense, I mean, there are at least two different festivals, but the American High School putting on a production of The Crucible, in some senses, is not appearing in the same festival as Ross Noble. But we found the big difficulty. We weren't quite sure whether to put it in comedy or whether to put it in theatre. We thought, if we put it in theatre, are people going to come along with expectations of something well-mounted and theatrical? And we wanted to be a bit more sort of sleeves rolled up than that. If we put it on in comedy, we're going to have people coming along expecting stand-ups. So in the end, we went for the comedy. I think now probably people are more prepared for for that sort of thing. And also, people are better at marketing themselves. I mean, we only spent a couple of grand or something back then, which felt like a lot of money, but it wasn't nearly enough. There are certain things, if you're going to have a hope of being noticed,
Do you know how much it costs? I mean, how much did it cost you, and how much does it cost now, do you think, to take a small...
Well, a friend of mine who's doing it fairly on the hoof, who's doing it actually at a C venue, he was sort of taking me through the various costs, including an eighth of a page in the Fringe programme.
Drinks for the press and marketing manager.
That kind of thing. Well, he did actually include drinks in his bill. He insisted that actually there was no point going up there if you didn't schmooze with business people or with your fellow performers. But anyway, it's a fairly sort of, you know, low to medium scale production. It's 12 grand. I think if he gets that back, he'd be very happy indeed. And I don't think he really expects to. But that's quite cheap.
Well, I don't know whether you have average figures in your head, but that seems to me quite a lot of money to pull together for one of the greatest parties on earth, but it's a lot of money to put down and not recoup on. I mean, do you think that is going to prevent... I mean, a lot of people say that the festival is now getting rather homogeneously middle class and quite white and home counties and all this kind of thing, that there aren't, you know, that it is a, there is a barrier, really, effectively, for participation now. Do you think that these costs are exclusive?
I guess it depends on how good you are at persuading the venue to take a risk on your show. That's probably the best way to get your costs down or even to minimise your risk in advance. And if you can get your venue to take the complete risk on your show, I mean, they won't pay for your drinks, unless you're really lucky. But if you can persuade the venue to take a box office risk, and that happens in London fringe theatres as well, the same thing can happen in Edinburgh. It's not common, but if it's a top show, that will happen. But also another way of reducing your risk is to do more than one show. So if you've got a show that, oh, it's a known writer and you know it's going to be a commercial kind of break even, then you can take a risk on the new writing, on the mime or whatever it is. And you can balance those risks, and quite a lot of people do that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the big venue empires are, to an extent, being portrayed here as personifications of the vice of commercialism. And that may be true in some respects, but in others, it's simply the case that the bigger the venues, the more able they are to have that flexibility of cutting deals, of offering straight box office splits with little or no upfront guarantee, which is certainly, yeah, again, what worked with the shows I took up. We managed to slash expenses to the bone by dint of getting good deals, calling in favours, of my already being up there as a journalist and getting free accommodation, etc. etc.
We let you get away with it too easily, didn't we?
Absolutely. for my 11 people per performance. So there is this flexibility of deals. And again, you know, we talk about how dreadfully much it costs and how little hope there is of recouping. The same is going to be true in the London Fringe, not to the same degree. But, you know, the Edinburgh experience in this respect isn't a creature entirely apart. It's just written slightly larger and slightly bolder.
If you're a group from university and you want to go to the pole, or you want to sail wherever it is, you have to raise the money for that exercise. And there's not a hope in hell's chance of getting any of it back. At least if you go up to the Edinburgh Festival, you are able to get some of it back, however little. So I don't think it's that expensive. I mean, just think what it costs to go on some sort of adventure, even Worldwide Explorer, or whatever it is, Explore Worldwide. You can be paying, you know, $1,000, $2,000 each to do something interesting, and you add that up by a party, and it's the same sort of figure we're coming to, because you only need six people on that, and it's still going to cost you £12,000. So it isn't that expensive. Of course it's horrendous if you don't get anything back, and you sit there miserably every night doing a performance and there's nobody there. I'm afraid that happens. I'm afraid it happens just as much in the presence as it happens anywhere else. We make some awful choices and get some awful shows, and I don't want to be like that man who sold diamonds and completely do us down, because I think we've got some damn good things as well. But somewhere along there is something that we take a risk on, and you do take a risk all the time. We do a 60-40 split in favour of the performers. There are certain companies, places this year that are doing better deals than that. But it is that risk, and the guarantees, if we pulled in all the guarantees, we would get something like a quarter to a third of what we actually need to pay the bills at the end. So there is a bit of a punt going on by people who run venues.
Do you think that there is a need for something that gives the theatre shows that take place in Edinburgh greater prominence? I mean, the abiding media interest at the festival seems to be at the moment with the Perrier Award and the comedy scene, and for understandable reasons, it's the kind of gladiatorial experience, and you can really, as it were, match comics against comics and see who wins. But, I mean, the noble exception of The Scotsman that produces a very fine series of awards, actually, south of the border, it can be quite hard to work out really what has succeeded. You know, there are five stars splashed around with gay abandon quite often. The critics have very little time to form kind of meaningful judgments. But there is no really sort of serious identifier of the, as it were, the really good, the best of the fest. Do you think that would help the theatre side of things at the festival?
Yeah, I think the Perrier definitely gives the comedy a structure, a three-act structure in a way. You know, who's going to be nominated? They've nominated who? Who's won? It's got all that. Whereas, as you say, theatre, the odd good review or bad review will come into the radar, but you don't get a sense of it being part of a general scene or general development. It seems much more atomised in the theatre. And yes, if there could be some kind of rinky-dinky gladiatorial element to the theatre. I mean, of course, we're in danger of turning everything into a competition, but that would certainly increase its prominence, yeah.
Mm. Well, who would organise it and how? I was thinking of this matter before I came here. And one thing that occurs to me as a possible explanation for the prominence of the Perrier is quite simply that the Perrier is the only one of the significant awards I can think of that engages professional PR. The other awards are based around newspapers or charitable activities by companies like British Gas, and they simply have their in-house publicity section sending out releases or giving discreet plugs in their pages. The Perrier actually set out to grab attention time and again, and God help us, we all fall into line with it.
But there are theatre. I mean, the stage do their awards, the Fringe First, which is the biggest, gets enough plug.
Yeah.
And newspapers are the ideal people to set up those sort of awards because they've got people going to see things.
Yeah, and one of the greatest awards, I think, nothing to do with my being involved for several years, was the award run by the Independent in the late 80s, early 90s, which was at the time unique on the Edinburgh Fringe in that it was practical. It wasn't a nice gong, it wasn't a nice cheque, it wasn't a nice plaque. What it was the paper would bankroll a London run for the deserving show. In the time I was involved, it was in the Hampstead Theatre. That was a significant 2 to 5 week run, depending on what kind of business they thought it would do. Yeah, that was a significant break. That the Indie Award, I died in, I think, 94. There is, I believe, a new award this year.
New York.
Yeah, which will bankroll a two-night showcase performance off Broadway. But other than those leg ups, there's little sense of practical advantage in an award. Once again, the Perrier has managed to create this air about itself that getting the Perrier in itself constitutes promotion into a different league. And to all intents and purposes, gives that break that otherwise would have to be formally organised.
I mean, I think the West End theatres could sniff around a bit more at what happens in Edinburgh. I mean, Jerry Springer, the opera, is a notable exception, and that, it's a musical or opera, but it also does a lot for theatre's profile at the Fringe because it's not comedy, but everyone knows that it was that. The show that started it, the cult hit from Edinburgh Fringe. And there's a lot of talk about, we know that, but it had to go to Edinburgh to get the real cogs turning.
And look at Soho's programme for the autumn, and you'll find that most of it comes out of the pages of the Fringe programme. Mm. They are. You'd be around on that Friday, Saturday of the last weekend, of the English Bank Holiday weekend, and it's like sharks and piranhas in a pool. They're all chasing for that one bit of stuff that they've got everybody else to go to, and it's very exciting. And they're going to take it and use it somewhere, and they do all the time. Yes, so yeah. It does feed to other things. Yes.
It also works the other way around. I've seen people at this table very recently sniffing around London shows to take them up to Edinburgh.
Absolutely, and then not getting it.
Yes.